had to laugh. "Is that right? Well, how about I serve it to you with another cup of coffee?" When he hesitated, not sure if she was joking or not, she said, "Don't worry about paying for this mess. We'll clean it up, and I'll get Myra's husband to fix the table. He's handy with things like that." "That's about all he's handy at," Myra said, causing the women to chuckle. When the food and coffee were all cleaned up off the floor, Pearlie, Liz, and Stella walked back down the street to the cattleman's. They paused at the door when Pearlie said he was going to say good night to them then. "I reckon I'll go on back to the stable. I'm thinking I'll head out early in the morning, so I'd best get some sleep." "Well, I reckon this is goodbye, till you happen through this way again," Liz said. "I'll tell you one thing, Pearlie. There's always something happening with you around. But speaking for myself, I'm gonna miss you. And I wish you were gonna be around from now on." On cue, Pearlie blushed. "That goes for me, too," Stella said. "You take care of yourself. Trouble seems to have a liking for you." He wished them good fortune and walked away. He had to admit that he had taken kind of a liking to them in the short time he had spent with them. But there was also the feeling that he had just lifted his foot out of a cow pie. He got back to the stable to find Tom Tuttle waiting for him.
"I was just fixing to lock up," Tuttle said. "Supper's waiting at the house, and I thought you must have changed your mind about sleeping in the barn."
"I got held up a little longer than I figured on," Pearlie said. "What time will you open up in the morning?" Tuttle said he'd be in at 6 for sure, maybe 5:30. So Pearlie decided he'd get on the trail to Denver as soon as Tuttle showed up and worry about breakfast when the horses needed a rest. In his brief exposure to Cheyenne, he hadn't seen anything that would cause him to want to tarry there. To the contrary, the prospect of Brady Ennis getting out of jail was reason enough to make him eager to leave. He felt no fear of Brady, but it always suited him to avoid trouble if he possibly could. After Tuttle left, Pearlie decided to help himself to Tuttle's oats with a portion for both of his horses. He thought about whether or not to tell Tuttle about it in the morning. After making sure his packs were ready to load onto the sorrel in the morning, he decided to sleep in the stall with Buck instead of in the barn hayloft as Tuttle had suggested. The big bay gelding probably needed the company. The night was passed peacefully enough, and Pearlie was pleased to see Tuttle arrive on time. After telling Tuttle the saga of his grandfather, he saddled Buck, loaded the pack horse, and told Tuttle he owed him for 2 portions of oats.
"You don't owe me anything," Tuttle insisted. "I hope you find your grandpa alive and well."
"Much obliged," Pearlie said, and stepped up into the saddle. "Follow the railroad straight south, right?"
"That's right," Tuttle replied. "The Denver Pacific Railway runs straight south for about 100 miles. You'll strike the South Platte about halfway there, and the railroad follows it right into Denver."
Pearlie touched his finger to his hat brim and turned Buck toward the railroad that the people of Denver had caused to be built when the Union Pacific ran their track through Cheyenne, 100 miles to the north, instead of Denver. Chapter 10 Riding alone once more, Pearlie was a whole lot more at ease, with nothing to set his mind on but finding his grandfather. Denver was where he aimed to start searching for him again, thinking that it was a good possibility the old man might indeed have had hopes of finding gold there. At least, that's what he kept telling his conscious mind. His inner thoughts were more in line with his brother John's thinking, that there wasn't a chance in hell that he would find any trace of his grandfather. Regardless of his success, however, one thing was for certain. The younger Pearlie Gates was going to see the Rocky Mountains. At the end of the first day, Pearlie rode into a sizable town lying beside a river near the foothills of the Front Range of the Rockies. It appeared to be a quiet town, although thriving,
judging by the appearance of the buildings he passed as he walked Buck down the main street. "Excuse me, sir," he said when he saw a man coming out of a barber shop. "What river is this?" "It's the Cache Laputa River," the man answered. Then guessing that Pearlie wasn't familiar with that, he added, "And if you're wondering where you are, you're in Fort Collins." "Much obliged," Pearlie said, unfamiliar with town or river. He had hoped he might have struck the South Platte, but he knew now that he had to be farther south. At any rate, the railroad went to Denver, so it was impossible to get lost. All day he had been riding with the lofty peaks of the mountains to the west of him, now so close that he thought he could feel their lure. He imagined that his grandfather had felt the same call of the mysterious range. He decided that he would camp on the bank of the river that night, and in the morning he would follow the river back up through the foothills in search of game. He was getting a little tired of salt pork. It was time to hunt for fresh meat. Following the pristine river back toward the mountains with his eyes, he figured there had to be deer or elk not far away. He was running low on supplies, too, a result of his taking Liz and Stella to Cheyenne, so he decided to stock up here in town. Realizing then that the man was waiting to see if he had any more questions, he apologized. "Sorry, I reckon I let my mind start wandering. Where's a good place to buy supplies, like coffee and flour and such?" "Steiner's is as good as any," the man replied, then turned and pointed, "right down the street on the other side." "Much obliged," Pearlie said again, and turned Buck's head toward the building the man had pointed out. He pulled his horses up beside a farm wagon tied at the rail and looked up and down the street before he went inside. Fort Collins seemed a far cry from a cattle town or a railroad town like Cheyenne. The people he had seen so far looked to be farmers. "Good evening, friend." A large, portly man with a full head of dark brown hair and a beard to match greeted him. "I'll be with you in a minute." The man went on to finish filling a bag with seed, then totaled up the order for a customer standing at the counter. When the customer had left, he turned his attention to Pearlie. He studied Pearlie for a few seconds before asking, "What can I do for you? Don't recall seeing you in the store before. Just passing through?" "Yes, sir," Pearlie answered politely. "I'm on my way to Denver, and I'm running short on some supplies. Thought maybe I could buy 'em here." He called off a few things and the quantity he needed. Satisfied with the sizable order and the cash it was paid with, the big man said, "My name's Louis Steiner. I appreciate you stopping in." He was curious about the polite young fellow, who looked like a cowhand, judging by the clothes he wore. "If you don't mind me asking, are you by any chance looking for a place to homestead? Because if you are, Fort Collins is the best place in the territory to claim a plot of land and raise a young family." "No, sir," Pearlie replied. "I ain't looking for a place to homestead. My family's got a ranch in Texas. I'm looking for my grandpa." He went on to explain, and when he had finished, he asked, just to be sure, "You ain't seen an old fellow named Pearlie Gates come through here, have you?" "No, sorry to say, I haven't," Steiner said. "I believe that's a name I would have remembered." "What makes you think he headed to Denver?" "Nothing, really, except he seemed to be heading that way when he left Ogallala, and folks said there was a lot of prospecting on Cherry Creek there." Steiner nodded while he considered that. "I expect it's too late to be looking for gold down there now. It's probably all mined out. Young fella like you would be better claiming a lot around here, like the other young families, build you a good farm and work to a solid future." "Well, like I said," Pearlie replied, "I ain't hunting for gold. I'm hunting for Grandpa." He picked up the sacks containing his purchases. "Thanks again for your help. I expect I'd best get along if I'm going to find something to eat before I camp for the night. Have you a wife back there in Texas?" "No, sir," Pearlie answered. "No wife." I expect you've probably had enough of suppers on the trail, haven't you? Steiner asked. That's a fact if there ever was one, Pearlie answered. But you get used to it, and it's better than going hungry. Well, why don't you have supper with me and the missus tonight? My wife always fixes more than we can eat, and she's always happy to meet new folks coming through town. Why, that's mighty kind of you, Pearlie said, more than a little surprised. But I wouldn't want to impose on you, and I wouldn't want to surprise your wife with an extra mouth to feed. She'd be tickled to have you. She always is. We don't eat till after I close the store at 5 o'clock. I'll be looking for you at that time right here. Pearlie was astonished. He wondered if Steiner treated all strangers to Fort Collins in the same way. I can always use a home-cooked supper, he said after a moment's hesitation, while he tried to think of a reason to refuse. Good, Steiner said. I'll see you back here at 5 o'clock. Who was that, Lewis? Mary Steiner asked when she came in from the back. Just some young fellow passing through town, Lewis answered. Seemed pretty solid. The kind we need more of in Fort Collins. She raised a suspicious eyebrow. You didn't try to marry off one of our daughters again, did you? Of course not, he huffed. Why would you think such a thing? He's on his way to look for his grandfather. I just felt kind of sorry for him, so I invited him to supper, figured you wouldn't mind. Why, Lewis Steiner, she scolded, you could have asked me before you go inviting any old drifter to the supper table. I don't think he's a drifter, and he ain't old, her husband replied in self-defense. I told you, he's trying to find his dear old grandpa. You should be ashamed of yourself, she railed. Our 5 beautiful daughters are precious to me, and you're always trying to sell them off like they were sacks of potatoes in your store. She bit her lip to keep from speaking profanely. You could have at least given me more time to fix extra food for some half-starved stranger. I've got to go home right now before Virginia puts the biscuits in the oven. We're going to need more if we're going to fill his belly. She gathered up her shawl and headed toward the back door, leaving her husband to exhale forcefully in frustration and call after her, "Tell them to put on some decent clothes." 5 daughters, he thought. In a territory where a man needs sons. 5 hungry mouths to feed. Virginia, his eldest at 22, well past marrying age. Callie and Eunice, right at marrying age. Ethel, not far from it, coming up on her 13th birthday, leaving only Hope, 11, and ugly as a mud fence. If God decided to burden him with 5 daughters, couldn't at least a couple of them have been a little more gentle on the eyes and give him an opportunity to have 2 sons-in-law? Who is he, Mama? Eunice asked as she prepared to set the table. I don't know, her mother replied. Some young man who just happened to come into the store. Your father thought he was a bright young fellow and decided it would be a nice thing to do to invite him to supper, trying to get more folks to move to Fort Collins, I guess. Where do you want to put him? Eunice asked. Put him next to your father so they can talk, I suppose. We'll set Virginia next to him, since she's the eldest. Then I don't guess it matters where the rest of you sit. Is he married? Virginia asked, as she walked into the dining room carrying a bowl of beans and another of potatoes. Your father didn't say, but it would be my guess that he's not, Mary said, knowing Lewis's motive. "'Is he handsome?' Callie asked, causing her sisters to giggle. "'I don't know,' Mary said. "'I didn't really see him. "'He was going out the door when I walked into the store.' She hesitated, but decided to do as her husband had suggested. "'And have a care about yourselves. Brush your hair.' "'You too, Hope. You look like you've been rolling in the pig pen. "'You told me to slop the hogs.' 11-year-old Hope complained. I didn't tell you to get in the pen with them, Mary said. Now, all of you, have a care for how you look. We've got company for supper, and it's almost time. They'll be turning up any minute.
At about 5 minutes to 5 o'clock, Pearlie showed up at the store, still undecided if he should impose on Steiner and his wife. It didn't seem the polite thing to do to surprise the woman with an extra mouth to feed. But the store owner had been so insistent with his invitation, so Pearlie figured he and his wife probably welcomed the opportunity to possibly hear some news from other parts of the country. As soon as he thought it, he had to chuckle. There wasn't much news he could tell them, except maybe that there were 2 new whores at the cattleman's in Cheyenne. He stepped down from the saddle just as Steiner came outside and paused to lock the door.
"Well, I see you're right on time," Steiner said. "I thought you'd likely leave your horses in the stable."
"I picked me out a good spot to camp over by the river," Pearlie said, "but I thought I'd best bring my horses with me. Fort Collins looks like a mighty nice town, but I didn't want to leave my pack horse down by the river."
"Right," Steiner replied. "I guess that's smart thinking, since you aren't staying at the hotel."
He nodded to himself, thinking the young man showed common sense.
"Well, come on. You can lead your horses. The house is on the street behind Main Street. I always walk it."
It was a short walk to the large white house with a wide porch across the front. Pearlie tied his horses to a corner post of the porch, just as Mary came out to greet them. She waited for them to climb the steps before speaking, making an intense inspection of the young man her husband had deemed worthy of an invitation to sit at her table.
"Welcome to our home," she said then.
"Thank you, ma'am," Pearlie replied, doing his best to be polite. "I have to apologize for dropping in on you like this, without any notice at all."
"It's no trouble. We're glad to have you. And if I know my husband, he probably didn't give you much choice."
She cast a sideways glance in Steiner's direction, which he acknowledged with an impish grin. She continued then,
"Come on inside and let's eat while the food's still hot."
Pearlie followed her into the parlor, where he found a young girl standing near the dining room door. No more than 10 or 11, he figured. She stared openly at him. He nodded to her, and she smiled back at him as she watched him walk past. So, they had a kid, he thought. He had somehow formed an impression that they had no children, and that that was the reason they invited company. That impression was destroyed a moment later when he walked into the dining room, where he was met with 3 young women of various ages, standing around one end of a large table. Before any introductions were offered, another woman came from the kitchen with a large platter of biscuits. She smiled at him as he placed the biscuits in the middle of the table and stepped back to stand beside her sisters.
"Louis," his wife reproached, "are you going to introduce our guest?"
"Oh, of course," Steiner fumbled. "This is Mr.—"
He started before realizing he didn't know his guest's name.
"Well, upon my soul, I don't believe I ever asked you your name."
"Pearlie Gates," he said.
"Pearlie Gates? I thought that was your grandfather's name."
"Yes, sir, it is. It's my name, too," Pearlie replied, aware of the amused expressions of astonishment on their faces. 11-year-old Hope could not suppress a giggle.
"Well, that's a most unusual name," Mary said, hastening to fill the void it had caused. "One I'm sure you're proud of."
"Not especially," Pearlie answered honestly. "But I reckon I've gotten used to it."
He smiled at her.
"Once you get past the name, I'm pretty much like everybody else."
"Well, we're glad to meet you, Mr. Gates," Mary said, with a frown in Hope's direction. She introduced each one of her daughters, starting with Virginia, and each one nodded in turn, still smiling broadly. "Let's sit down and eat. Mr. Gates, right here, next to Virginia," she directed, pulling out a chair for him.
Surprised, to say the least,
for he had hardly expected to have supper with so many women staring at him. Pearlie felt like a wild bear cub someone had rescued and was now watching to see his reactions to human beings. On the other hand, the food looked mighty good, so he reached for a biscuit just as Mary spoke again.
"Papa, I think we're ready. You can ask the blessing now."
Pearlie immediately jerked his hand back, causing Hope to giggle, and the polite smiles on the faces of the other four daughters to turn into amused grins. Embarrassed, he was happy to bow his head while Steiner embarked on a lengthy blessing that offered thanks not only for the food on the table, but that encompassed the fertile land that produced it. While he listened, Pearlie was touched, but not so much by Steiner's words as he was by the toe that began to caress his knee. He picked up at the daughter introduced as Callie, sitting directly across from him, but her head was bowed reverently, as was her sister's beside her. At the sound of Amen, Pearlie looked up quickly to find Callie smiling at him again, but with an expression that would indicate there was nothing going on under the table. He glanced at Virginia, seated beside him. She answered his glance with a smile, then promptly passed a bowl containing potatoes to him. There was no sign of mischief in her smile. That left only one other within easy reach of his knees. But surely it could not be Steiner's wife. So he decided it had to be Callie, she with the innocent expression on her face. The rubbing on his leg increased to the point where he felt he had to do something to stop it. He shifted his legs around, and the poking stopped for a few seconds, but started up again. Pearlie became extremely uncomfortable, and his brother's words came to his mind again. Another cow pie. He looked from Steiner to his wife. Neither seemed aware of the ill behavior of their daughter, and they appeared to be the kind of people who would not condone such carryings on. He was not sure what he should do, but he had suddenly lost his appetite. Mary Steiner noticed it and spoke up.
"For a strong young man like yourself, you don't seem to be very hungry. I hope the food is to your liking," she said, looking truly concerned.
"Oh, yes, ma'am," he quickly replied. "It's a fine supper. I reckon I'm just wanting to make it last a long time, so I'm eating it real slow." "Oh!" he yelped involuntarily when he was sure he felt a foot thrust up between his legs. His sudden eruption caused everyone to look at him in astonishment. Mary looked at once in Hope's direction. "Did you let that dog in the house again, young lady?" She didn't wait for Hope's answer. "Get him out of here. You know what I told you about letting Brutus in the house when we're eating?" Down at the end of the table, Hope displayed a pouty face, but dutifully got up from her chair. Taking a piece of a pork chop from her plate, she lifted the tablecloth and called, "Come on, Brutus, you've got to go outside." In a few seconds, a large hound, almost as tall as the table, came out from under it and followed Hope as she led it out the door.
"I hope you think we're a little more civilized than that, Mr. Gates," Mary said as Hope and the huge pooch left the room. "Hope lets that dog get away with practically everything he wants to do, but feeding him from the table is one thing I will not stand for."
"No, ma'am, not at all, ma'am," Pearlie responded, hoping the flush of embarrassment he felt in his face and neck was not obvious to see. As suddenly as it had left him, his appetite returned, and he began to eat as the hostess had expected him to.
"I believe you are hungry after all," Steiner commented.
"Eunice, pass Pearlie the beans. The girls all help with the cooking. Virginia bakes the best biscuits in the Colorado Territory. I'm going to lose her one day when the young men find out how good she can cook."
"I wouldn't be surprised," Pearlie said, thoroughly enjoying his supper now. "They're mighty good biscuits."
"Tell us about your home in Texas," Mary said.
"Not much to talk about," Pearlie replied. "It's just a cattle ranch, about a half-day's ride below the Red River." He went on to tell them about his brothers and his mother and the death of his father. "So that's the reason I'm trying to find my grandpa," he concluded.
"Sounds like yours is a hard-working family," Lewis Steiner commented. "This part of the Colorado Territory is shaping up to be a real thriving community and a land of great promise for any young man to raise a family in. Most of the folks who have been coming in are farmers, but there's a real need for men who work cattle."
"Yes, sir," Pearlie said. "Looks like a right nice town." It had not sunk in at first, but Pearlie suddenly realized that all of Steiner's conversation seemed to end with a sales pitch for Fort Collins, that is, when he wasn't touting the homemaking abilities of his daughters. Happening to notice several occasions during the supper when Mary aimed deep frowns in her husband's direction, Pearlie began to believe that she was not in favor of Steiner's efforts to interest him in any of the girls. Pearlie could understand his host's situation, saddled with 5 daughters, most of them grown, and none of them with husbands. "It's a shame they all seem to have inherited the looks from their father," he thought. "If they'd gotten a little bit more from their ma, they'd have a better chance of finding husbands." After he finished a slice of apple pie that Steiner said his daughter Eunice had made, Pearlie thanked Mary and all her daughters for the fine meal. "It was mighty nice of you folks to invite me, and I'm pleased to make all your acquaintances. I reckon I'd best be on my way now. I have to take care of my horses and set up my camp. I'll be getting an early start in the morning. I've been a while with nothing but salt pork, so I'm going up the river a ways to see if I can't find a deer. I saw plenty of signs of them by the river today."
"You could stay right here tonight," Steiner suggested. "Leave your horses in the backyard and eat a good breakfast in the morning."
The man doesn't give up easily, Pearlie thought. Mary had had enough, however, and said it for him.
"Oh, Lewis, you can see Pearlie has things to take care of that he can do better in his own camp. So let him go take care of his horses. Isn't that right, Pearlie?"
"Yes, ma'am, that's a fact. So I'll say thank you again, and good night to you all." With that, he took his leave, stepped up into his saddle, and turned Buck toward the river. Lewis and Mary and all 5 daughters stood on the porch to watch him leave.
"Well, he wasn't as dumb as his name," Hope declared.
"No, he isn't dumb," her mother said, still perturbed by her husband's campaign to interest their guest in their daughters. "I think he's a fine young man. It's just too bad he's not looking for a wife."
"Come on," he thought. "Come on down to the edge and get a drink. You know you're thirsty."
Crouching in a clump of berry bushes beside what looked to be a common crossing for deer, Pearlie watched the 4 of them as they approached the river. An old buck with 3 does made his target selection easy. He would take the best shot presented to him. He waited to let them drink, keeping his rifle sighted on one of the does in case they turned around instead of crossing the river. When they had satisfied their thirst, the old buck snorted a couple of times, then started across. Pearlie waited until the ladies followed, and when one young doe presented him with a perfect angle for a lung shot, he squeezed off the fatal round. She dropped immediately, while the other deer bolted up from the riverbank and disappeared into the fir trees on the slope beyond. He hurried out of the bushes and ran to the fallen deer, anxious to end her suffering. When he approached, the deer began struggling in a frantic effort to get up, so to make it quick, he drew his .44 Colt and put a bullet in her head.
"I'm awful sorry I had to do that," he apologized. He always felt sorry for animals he killed for food, a weakness he was always careful to hide from his brothers or anyone else for that matter. "If I could live on nothing but berries and such like you do, I reckon I would." The butchering of the deer was a different matter, however. He figured once the deer was dead, its spirit had gone on to wherever deer spirits went, leaving nothing but meat,
and venison was a hell of a lot tastier than sow belly. He decided to butcher his doe back at his camp, since it was not too far from town, and he didn't want to leave his pack horse unattended there too long. With that in mind, he loaded the carcass onto Buck and started back down the river. When within about 50 yards of the little clearing where he made his camp, Pearlie suddenly reined Buck back. Something was wrong. He smelled smoke. Then, looking up toward the tops of the trees, he saw faint traces of it drifting up from what had to be the spot where he had camped. He was sure he had put his fire out before going after the deer. Someone must have come upon his camp and his pack horse. He was stupid to have left the horse for the short time he was gone, only to have it stolen. "Well, we'll see about that," he thought, and urged Buck ahead slowly. When about 20 yards closer, he halted Buck and dismounted. Leaving the bay gelding there in the trees, he made his way cautiously toward the clearing until abruptly stopping when he spotted a figure sitting beside his campfire. Glancing over toward the edge of the river, he saw his pack horse grazing, and he couldn't help wondering why the man hadn't taken the horse and fled if that had been his goal. "Reckon we'll find out," Pearlie thought, and pushed on through the trees, holding his rifle ready to fire. "Didn't know I was having company," he called out, in lieu of something better. Startled, the figure by the fire jumped, then spun around to face him. Pearlie held his rifle ready, but there was no move by his guest to draw a weapon. And for a frozen moment, the two of them stood staring at each other in astonishment. "What the?" Pearlie exclaimed. "What are you doing here?" he finally managed, trying to recall who this was. "I can't place your name right now." "I'm Ethel," Steiner's 13-year-old daughter said. "I thought I could find your camp, and when I saw the pack horse I knew it was yours." "Yeah. So what can I do for you?" Pearlie asked. "Did your folks send you to find me?" "No. Mama and Papa are at the store, just like every day," Ethel answered. "What about your sisters? Did you tell them you were going to find my camp?" Pearlie asked, still baffled by the young girl's appearance. "No, I don't have to tell them everything I'm going to do." Still baffled, Pearlie had to ask, "Well, is there something you want from me?" "I want to go with you," she stated frankly. "I'll dry up and blow away if I have to stay here much longer. I can help you do the cooking and anything else you need. And you don't have to worry. I didn't tell anybody I was coming with you." Pearlie found it hard to believe what he was hearing. "Ethel, you're mighty young to ride off with some man you don't even know. I wouldn't know what to do with you anyway. Besides, I'm going to be on the trail for a long time, looking for my grandpa. Then I'll be heading back to my home in Texas. I don't think you'd enjoy that very much." "I'd like to see Texas," Ethel said. "And I'm older than you think." "No, you ain't," Pearlie replied abruptly. "You run off from home and you'll break your mama's heart. You need to wait till you're a couple years older to think about taking up with a man. You'll have plenty of time to meet the right one for you. Fort Collins is growing every year. You'll have a lot to choose from." She wasn't convinced. "I don't know about that. Virginia's 22, and she's still waiting for somebody. I can't wait till I'm 22. "Take my word for it," he said in conclusion. "In the next couple of years, the men around here are going to outnumber the women, so it's best to stay right here." Considering that to be his final word on the matter, he now had another problem. "I'll take you back home, but it'll have to wait a little while. I've got to skin and butcher a deer and smoke it before the meat goes bad. The weather's getting warmer now, and I'm afraid to wait too long to dry the meat. And it'd be a sin to kill an animal like a deer unless you use the meat." There was the matter of a missing girl at the Steiner house, however, which complicated things. "Are your folks going to miss you if you're gone for a while?" "Like I said, Papa and Mama are at the store. I go off all the time without telling my sisters. They don't care anyway, so I can help you with the deer," Ethel offered quickly, although she could just as easily have gone home without escort, the same way she had arrived, but she still had hope of changing his mind.
"Maybe so," Pearlie allowed. "At least we can get it started."
He pressed his thumb and forefinger to his lips and whistled a short blast. In a few seconds, Buck came trotting out of the trees with the deer carcass on his back. It was well past noon by the time Pearlie had butchered the deer and had it ready to smoke over a makeshift fire pit. Since neither of them had eaten anything that morning, he had Ethel make coffee and cut some strips of the fresh meat to cook over the fire. When they were done, the two sat down to eat, and that's what they were doing when Deputy Sheriff Martin Sumner rode into the clearing.
"Well, you ain't the smartest kidnapper I've ever seen," Sumner announced, surprising the two. With a double-barreled shotgun leveled at Pearlie, he carefully dismounted. "Are you all right, Ethel?" When Pearlie started to get up, Sumner warned him. "You sit right where you are till I get some answers. I ain't got no patience for men like you who take advantage of young girls."
"I think you're jumping to the wrong conclusion," Pearlie started to explain, but Sumner cut him short.
"You just keep your trap shut till I tell you to talk," Sumner ordered. Then he turned to Ethel. "Tell me what happened, Ethel. What are you doing here?"
Frustrated by having been caught by the deputy, Ethel was about to confess that it was she who was at fault for being there. Then, thinking that the deputy might force Pearlie to marry her, she replied,
"He had his way with me, Deputy Sumner. Snatched me right up off the street and brought me out here to his camp."
"What?"
Pearlie exclaimed. "I did no such thing. Ethel, tell the man the truth."
"I ain't gonna tell you again,"
Sumner warned him and cocked both hammers on his shotgun.
"I did tell him the truth, darling," Ethel cried out dramatically. "You promised we'd get married. That's the only reason I let you have your way with me."
"That's a damn lie," Pearlie exclaimed.
"She showed up here when I came back from hunting. She's making the whole thing up."
"Get on your feet," Sumner ordered. "Now unbuckle that gun belt and let it drop."
When Pearlie hesitated, Sumner threatened,
"Mister, I ain't got no use for your kind. I just wish you'd give me a reason to blast a hole in your belly."
Pearlie could see he had no choice, so he did as he was told.
"Now," Sumner continued, "you're gonna saddle that horse and pack up those sacks on your pack horse. Then we're gonna ride back into town, and you can see how you like our jail while we decide what to do with you."
Pearlie made one more attempt to protest, and received a blow to his head from the butt of Sumner's shotgun that sent him to the ground. Once aboard Buck, Pearlie led Sumner and his pack horse out of the clearing, his handgun and his rifle in Sumner's possession, with the deputy's assurance that he was a crack rifle shot, in case Pearlie decided to run for it. Ethel rode behind the deputy, all the while afraid that her plan had backfired, but in too deep to confess. When they completed the short trip back to town, Sumner guided Pearlie to the jail, where they were met in front of the two-story building by Sheriff Lloyd James.
"Good work, Martin," James greeted him. "I was fixing to round up a posse to go after him. Where'd you find him?"
Sumner told him down by the river, smoking venison.
"He give you any trouble?" James asked.
"Not really," Sumner replied. "I had to give him a tap on the head to let him know I weren't playing, that's all."
"There's been a misunderstanding, Sheriff," Pearlie said as he stepped down.
"I'm sure there has," James said. "Take him on inside and lock him up."
He reached up and helped Ethel off Sumner's horse.
"You all right, honey?"
Afraid to open her mouth now, she just nodded.
"You run on over to your daddy's store. They've been sick worrying about you. We'll take care of this feller."
Reluctant to look at Pearlie, She lowered her head and hurried down the street to the store. Watching her as she walked away, Sumner said, "The son of a bitch raped her."
"I did not touch her,"
Burley insisted. The sheriff looked at him with a cold eye.
"You're lucky we've got law and order in this town, so you'll get a chance to tell that to a judge. I'd just as soon hang you if it was left up to me."
Burley could see that he didn't have a chance for justice without a confession from Ethel, and it appeared she was going to stick to her story.
"What are you going to do with my horses?"
"Don't worry about them," James said. "We'll take them down to the stable and take real good care of them. After your trial and your hanging, we'll most likely auction them off." He nodded toward his deputy. "Take them on in."
"You'd best lead that bay," Burley said. "He doesn't like anybody but me on his back."
"Is that a fact?" James replied and grinned at his deputy.
"Hear that, Martin? After you put Mr. Pearly Gates in a cell, you'd best lead his horse down to the stable. You don't want to get bucked off."
"Maybe I'd better," Sumner said, while he pulled Pearly's saddlebags off his horse. He pushed Pearly inside, dropped the saddlebags on Sheriff James's desk, then marched Pearly upstairs to a cell. Pearly sat frustrated on the one small cot in his cell, wondering how he was going to recover from stepping in this latest cow pie, when he heard Buck snort and neigh on the street in front of the jail. Buck's warning snorts were heard again, this time followed by a loud howl, then a dull thump. Pearly didn't have to see it to know what had just happened. He shook his head slowly and muttered, "I warned you," while the sounds of Sumner's cursing carried to the second floor of the jail.
Chapter 11. While Pearly was locked in a cell on the second floor of the jail, Ethel presented herself to her parents, who welcomed her tearfully.
"Where were you?" Mary Steiner cried when her daughter walked in the door. "Are you all right? We've been worried sick. We even went to the sheriff when Callie came to the store and told us you had disappeared."
"I'm sorry, Mama," Ethel cried. "Martin Sumner found me and brought me back to town."
She was afraid to admit what she had done, thinking that her best bet was to stick to the story she had fabricated.
"I didn't know he was going to grab me."
"Who?" her father demanded. "Who grabbed you?"
"Pearly Gates," Ethel whimpered.
"That son of a bitch," Steiner roared. "I invited him into my home. He broke bread with my family."
He took Ethel by her shoulders, looking into her eyes.
"What did he do to you?"
When she refused to answer, he shook her violently.
"What did he do to you?"
"He had his way with me," she lied. "I think he wants to marry me."
Her father was beside himself with anger, unable to talk for a full minute. He sputtered and fumed while Mary took their daughter in her arms and held her.
"You're safe now," she said. "Home, where you belong."
She looked at her husband and confessed,
"I've never been so wrong about a person in my life. I thought he was a decent young man."
Able to think rationally again, Steiner questioned Ethel then.
"You said Martin Sumner brought you back. Did he arrest Pearly Gates?"
Ethel, still in her mother's embrace, nodded.
"So he's in jail?"
She nodded again.
"I'm going up there," Steiner told his wife. "You take her home."
"We can't both leave the store, Lewis," Mary responded. "What are you going to do anyway?"
When he insisted that he had to go talk to the sheriff, she said,
"All right. But wait till I take Ethel home, and you can go when I get back."
Although still fuming, he realized what she said was true. He couldn't leave their store unattended. Trapped in the web of lies she had created, Ethel went home with her mother, where she was welcomed with great relief by all her sisters. Mary told them what had happened to Ethel, and their reaction was total shock, just as it had been with their mother and father. When Mary left her in their care and went back to the store, they questioned her in depth about her abduction. She was inclined to be a little more explicit with the details of the incident than she had been with her mother, unable to resist an attempt to arouse envy. Instead of buying into her fantasy, however, they were inclined more toward skepticism, knowing their sister better than her mother did. Virginia looked at Callie and winked, then addressed Ethel.
"You seem like you're feeling much better now."
When Ethel said that she was, Virginia said, "Good, 'cause we've got to take care of you, if he's done everything to you that you've said. We'll need to clean you up. I'd think that's the first thing you'd want."
"Yes," Ethel quickly agreed. "I want to clean myself up after what I've been through. I'll do that now."
"No," Virginia said. "We'll take care of you. You've been through too much.
Hope, go to the pump and get a basin of water. Bring a washcloth and a bar of soap."
"I don't need anybody to help me clean up," Ethel protested.
"No trouble at all," Callie said. "We'll do it, and that way we can see how much damage was done. And maybe we can clean you up to make sure you don't have a baby."
She winked at Virginia.
"No, confound it," Ethel insisted. "I don't want anybody touching me. I'll take care of myself."
"I'll bet you made the whole thing up," Eunice said. "We'll know for sure when we get a look at your bottom."
"Ain't nobody getting a look at my bottom," Ethel exclaimed. "Anybody tries, we'll get a sock in the eye."
"Is that so?" Eunice shot back. "I believe the four of us can hold you down."
"No, you won't," Ethel cried, and started to run from the room. But Callie caught her by the arm.
In a matter of seconds, her four sisters grabbed her and wrestled her to the floor, where her undergarments were discarded. The decision was easily unanimous. She had never been violated.
"How did you find him?"
Virginia asked calmly when Ethel finally quit struggling. Knowing her story had crumbled around her, Ethel didn't try to pursue it.
"I walked up the river till I found where he camped."
"Why in the world did you make up that story?" Callie asked. "Didn't you know you would ruin that good man?"
"I thought the sheriff or the judge would make him marry me, and I'd get out of this damn town."
"More likely they're getting ready to hang him," Eunice said. "We've got to go tell the sheriff the truth."
"No," Ethel cried. "I don't want everybody in town knowing about it."
"You can't let that man be punished for your foolishness," Virginia said. "Sheriff James is a thoughtful man. We can probably ask him to keep it quiet."
She looked at her younger sister, waiting for her remorse. Knowing that she was not without a sense of honor, she was merely foolish, as a 13-year-old can be. Ethel hung her head in shame. Tears streamed down her cheeks as she surrendered to her conscience.
"You're right. I can't let him be punished. He didn't do anything. He was going to bring me home."
She looked up at her big sister.
"Will you go with me to tell Papa and Mama?"
"I'll go with you," Virginia said.
She felt compassion for her young sister, but she had already planned to accompany her to the store, in case Ethel faltered in her promise to tell the truth.
Pearlie could hear Steiner's angry ranting downstairs in the sheriff's office, demanding swift justice instead of waiting for a trial for the man who kidnapped and violated his 13-year-old daughter. While Sheriff James fully understood the outrage the poor man was suffering, he was steadfast in his intention to carry out the letter of the law. When Steiner hinted that it might be easy to incite enough of his irate citizens to form a lynch mob, James made it abundantly clear that there would be no lynch mob in his town, and that Steiner would likely wind up in jail with Pearlie if he was to try to put one together. Pearlie decided that the sheriff was a good, conscientious man, and Fort Collins was fortunate to have him. However, he was still in jail awaiting trial. Pearlie heard someone come into the office, and a moment later a woman's voice carried upstairs to his cell. After that there was a lot of talking by male and female voices, and he thought one of them sounded like Mary Steiner, no doubt come to demand justice for her daughter. Pearlie shook his head, wondering why he seemed to find himself in awkward situations more than most other people. Things got quiet. Then he heard someone coming up the stairs to the cell room. A moment later, Deputy Sumner appeared in the doorway, holding a key on a ring. He walked straight to Pearlie's cell and unlocked the door, then motioned for him to come out. "Lynching?" Pearlie asked, thinking maybe Sheriff James had caved in to pressure. Sumner smothered a chuckle. "Nah, nothing like that. Sheriff wants you downstairs." When he got downstairs, Pearlie was startled to see not only Steiner and his wife, but Ethel as well. James plopped his saddlebags, his rifle, and his .44 on the desk. With a wary suspicion, as if he was being set up for something, Pearlie looked from one face to another, from the sheepish expression on Steiner's wide countenance to the contrite smile on his wife's face. As for Ethel, he could not see her face as she stared at the floor. After what seemed a long moment, the sheriff spoke. "There's been a big misunderstanding here. Looks like my deputy and I owe you an apology. Miss Ethel here has confessed that she let her imagination stampede and ended up causing you a heap of trouble. But thank goodness we got the straight of it before Mr. Steiner rounded up a lynching party." "I swear, I'm sorry we doubted you, Pearlie," Steiner said. "I think Ethel has something to say to you as well," Mary said, and she poked the humiliated young girl in the back with her forefinger. "Yes, sir," Ethel managed to mumble before her mother told her to speak up. "I'm sorry I caused you so much trouble, Pearlie." Pearlie was amazed. It was one of the most bizarre situations he had ever found himself in. It was his first time in jail for anything, much less for abusing a child. "I reckon no real harm came of it," he said, unable to think of anything better. He found himself feeling sorry for the girl. He looked at the sheriff. "Am I free to go now?" "Yes, sir," James said, and apologized again for arresting him. "How about my horses? Where are they?" "Down at the stable at the end of the street," the sheriff said. "Tell Orin I said to let you take them. There shouldn't be any charge after this short time, but if there is, tell him I'll take care of it." A mischievous smile parted his lips, and he couldn't resist adding, "Martin decided to ride that bay of yours down there, but changed his mind and led him down to Orin's." Deputy Sumner grinned sheepishly. "I think you might have broke my tailbone when I landed on the seat of my pants. Maybe I ought to charge you for my doctor bill." Pearlie chuckled. "You'll have to take that up with Buck. Maybe he'll give you a free ride to make up for that first one." "No thanks," Sumner said. "I don't need no more flying lessons." "I reckon I'll be getting along now," Pearlie said, and picked up his belongings from the sheriff's desk. They all walked out to the street with him, and Steiner and his wife and daughter walked with him as far as the store. "Don't be too hard on Ethel," Pearlie said in parting. "I'm sure she meant no real harm." The family stood in front of the store and watched as he walked toward the lower end of the street with his long, loose gait. "I'd have gone with him if he would have had me," Ethel remarked, already recovering some of her natural brass. Pearlie believed very much in the popular saying, "The Lord moves in mysterious ways."
He thought about that as he walked down the street, a free man, after having thought he was heading toward a rope around his neck. Somehow Ethel was persuaded to confess, against what he considered to have been pretty high odds. In reality, he was about to find the real miracle when he set foot in the stable and met Orin Jones.
"How do?" Orin greeted him, walking out of a stall with a pitchfork in his hand.
"Howdy," Burley returned. "I believe you've got a couple of horses that belong to me."
"Deputy Sumner brought them down here about an hour or so ago."
"That bay and the sorrel pack horse?" Orin replied. "Martin said the owner was going to be in jail for a while."
"You didn't shoot nobody to get out of jail, did you?"
He said it as a joke, but truthfully, he wasn't sure.
"Nope," Pearlie said. "It was a case of the wrong man. Sheriff James said he'd take care of any charges you had."
He purposely refrained from telling Orin what the actual circumstances were, to keep from bringing shame to Ethel and her family. Orin shrugged.
"Well, I ain't really done nothing for him yet. I was fixing to feed him a portion of oats, but you got here before I did that."
"Well, go ahead and give him the oats," Pearlie said, "as long as the sheriff said he'd pay for them. I reckon he owes me at least that much for throwing me in jail."
Orin chuckled and, extending his hand, said,
"Why not, mister? I didn't catch your name."
"Gates," Pearlie supplied and shook his hand.
"Pearlie Gates, Mr. Jones."
"My stars!" Orin exclaimed. "If that ain't the dangedest coincidence I've ever seen.
That's a mighty curious name. Wouldn't figure you'd meet anybody by that name."
"I ain't saying there's anything wrong with it," he hastened to assure Pearlie.
"It's just an unusual name, and to meet two men with it don't seem likely to happen, and within about 3 months' time at that."
Seeing the look of astonishment on Pearlie's face, he was moved to ask,
"Have you got any kinfolk out this way?"
"My grandpa," Pearlie answered at once. "I was on my way to Denver to find him when I stopped here in Fort Collins."
"Well, you wouldn't have found him in Denver. When he came through here, he was heading to Cheyenne, on his way to the Black Hills, like a heap of other folks looking to strike it rich."
Feeling like he could be knocked over with a feather, Pearlie was at a loss for a moment before he could think to ask questions.
"How long was he here?" he finally asked.
"Not long," Orin replied. "I don't think he stopped anywhere else but my place. He wanted to sell me an extra horse he had with him, but we couldn't get together on a price. So he said he'd try to sell it in Cheyenne. If it had been a good horse, I might have given him something for it, but it was a damn nigh swayback."
He paused when Pearlie seemed to be thinking about something other than his conversation.
"You say you're taking your horses?"
Pearlie jerked his head back to the present.
"Yeah," he said. "I'm taking them."
When Orin went to get the grain bucket for the oats, Pearlie's mind went back to where it had flown a few moments before. He had to wonder about the coincidence that stopped him from going on to Denver and led him back to his grandfather's track. Maybe he was beholden to Ethel Steiner after all. Had she not pursued him and then concocted her outrageous story, he would have surely gone off in the wrong direction to have any chance to find his grandpa. "The Lord moves in mysterious ways, all right," he thought. When he got his pack horse loaded again and his saddle on Buck, he said so long to Orin Jones and thanked him for the information about his grandfather. Already having lost the time he had spent riding south from Cheyenne, he was anxious to head back in the other direction. It was well past noon by that time, however, so he knew he would not get to Cheyenne by the end of the day. It wouldn't matter if he set out immediately or waited until later, so he decided to ride back up the river to check on the condition of his camp. When he reached the bend of the river, he rode through the fir trees hugging the bank to the clearing where he had made his camp the night before. Nothing had been disturbed. The fires he had started to smoke the strips of venison had all burned out, but from all appearances, the dried-out meat looked to be perfectly fine, still staked out just as he had left it.
To be sure, he tried some of the meat and found it to be usable. Another unlikely coincidence, he thought, and further evidence that he was supposed to find his grandpa. Encouraged by the way things had fallen into place for him, Pearlie went into his packs for some cloth to wrap the venison with,